Box to Box Stoppage Time.
Can you believe it?
For Chemist Warehouse.
Great savings every day.
And Hoyt's Herbs and Spices.
Changing the mood of food.
And this could be the most crucial goal of all.
Hello and welcome to Box Stoppage Time, where over the next 25 minutes, we'll wrap our games, teams and hot topics from yet another massive week of football. Willem van Denderen with you, Derek Dyson and Michael Edgley with me. Del's got the new ball in Healesville from the Sanctuary end. Derek, your game of the week, please.
Thanks, Willem. I could have, you know, I was very tempted to go with the Man United Coventry game, which of course threw up a whole bunch of storylines that we covered in the main show, but one we didn't cover in the main show was in the Scottish Cup semi-final, and that was the one between Celtic and Aberdeen. Now, I watched this one with my dad on the final evening of my holiday. We were scouring and trying to find something to watch, and this was found this one on Paramount Plus, and I introduced my dad to the wonders that is Paramount Plus. So he was a bit bemused at absolutely no build-up, just a lot of wide shots of an empty stand. And what was probably more unbelievable was no replays. So when the first goal went in after 2 minutes, when he was looking at his phone, for some reason the feed didn't have any of the replays on it at all. It's possibly because the BBC feed would have been covered in BBC type swirls or whatever it is. So we literally couldn't see the first goal again. So literally unmissable stuff. We managed to listen to the halftime analysis so you could hear it, but you couldn't see it. It was just the locked-off shot of the empty stands again. So, yeah, I don't think my dad will be downloading Paramount Plus anytime soon. And but thankfully, it was an excellent game. Aberdeen took the lead after 2 minutes, as I said. Coon equalised for Celtic before half-time. It was looking like Celtic were going to get to the victory at 2-1, but Solker scored in the 89th minute to take it to extra time. Celtic thought they had it won again with a rocket from O'Reilly, but McDonald was there at the back post with 1 minute left from the cross to take it to penalties. It was a high-quality shootout. Joe Hart, the 37-year-old English goalkeeper, had a chance to win, took Celtic's fifth penalty. It wasn't a bad penalty, actually. He hit the post. It was low and well struck. But a miss for Aberdeen allowed Celtic to win the game later on. They will play Rangers in what already looks like a tantalising final. So a 5-star game, but from my dad, 0 stars for that Paramount feat, Willem.
Well, did you feel a degree of cultural cringe in showing your dad our product, Derek? Because it's embarrassing, and this wasn't an A-League or A-League's women's production. This is secondary, where they, you know, pick up a smattering of whatever else they can grab for the cash they have, and they've clearly showed this, and they also show a bit of English FA Cup. But did you feel embarrassed showing your dad this is, to an extent, Australian football?
A little bit. Look, I tried to explain to him the limitations. You know, they would have paid a very, very low fee for that feed. I don't think they would have been expecting bumper audiences for the game, but just how sort of rough it was. Just don't even, you know, just show some other highlights at halftime, or, you know, but you know, the fact that there were no replays of any of the goals was just absolutely bamboozling. So yeah, it wasn't a great immersion for him in Paramount Plus.
Edge, staying, what did Donald Trump say? This is possibly the worst deal in the history of deals, possibly ever. Edge, your game, Leicester 2, West Brom 1.
Yes, I went for this derby in the Championship because it was a crucial game for Leicester City, who went in to the match only 2 points ahead of Leeds in third position. Before the game started, there was 4 games to go in the Championship, and we're at the pointy end, and we just know how much rides on promotion to the Premier League. And it was a typical derby between those two clubs. It was high in emotion, played at a frenetic pace, and West Bromwich actually opened up, who were themselves well-placed to make. They won't make automatic promotion, but they will make the finals and give themselves a chance to work their way up into the Premier League through a playoff process. But they opened up the game full of energy, and Hasmat Chowdhury made his first of three goal line clearances for Leicester City throughout the day. Probably earned himself the man of the match performance because of that. But they were under siege early. The Baggies missed a string of chances in the first 20 minutes. And then Leicester got a goal in the 22nd minute through Ndidi. And then in the second half, Leicester was happy to sit, soak up the pressure from West Bromwich Albion. And then this happened on the break.
Vestergaard wins it back, though. And here is Fatawu after 64 minutes. Leicester have soaked up so much pressure. Fatawu jinking feet to get beyond his man. And the header from Jamie Vardy makes it two. As Leicester look to take a giant stride, perhaps towards the Premier League.
Well, it was that man, Jamie Vardy. We've heard Rob, our great mate Rob Tanner from The Athletic, and before that, the Leicester Mercury sing his praises over the last 5 years. And I just thought it was prophetic in such a big game, Jamie Vardy was to score the winner, especially because he missed a penalty in the first half as well. But that win over West Brom did get a goal, and it was a very nervous, jittery end to the match for Leicester fans at the King Power Stadium. But as a result of that goal by Jamie Vardy, Leicester came away 2-1 winners, and they are now 4 points clear of Leeds in third spot with three games to go. And they're on the precipice of an automatic return to the Premier League, which I was very fearful for the Leicester City club, that they wouldn't do this, that they wouldn't bounce back. And I think, Derek, you would agree, any team that goes down to the Championship and can reorganise itself and come straight back up is a very good sign. And we know the quality and the storylines behind Leicester City, in particular their chairman dying in a helicopter crash, who's invested so much money into that club. It's a good story if they come back, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, no club is entitled to Premier League football, and Leicester, of course, are very storied in the recent history of the competition and that fantastic season that they gave us a few seasons ago. They were shorn of a lot of their top talent when they went down. And Harvey Barnes, of course, went to Newcastle. They lost Yuri Tielemans to Aston Villa. Obviously, Kasper Schmeichel moved on. But they did manage to keep some of the core of that team together. And, of course, they benefit. We were talking about this with Nancy Frostick in the main show, that they do benefit from the parachute payments. And you know, you've got to take advantage of that pretty quickly, because it is a competitive advantage in the league to have that extra Premier League money in your bank account as you get back into the Championship. But yeah, you're right. I think the objective has got to try and rebound as quickly as possible. Not everyone does it. Think about Huddersfield, for example, who were in the Premier League, nearly got relegated into League Two. They nearly fell through the pyramid, and that's just as easy as, you know, easier in a way than trying to stay up. So, yeah, we spoke with Nancy about the fact that Leeds and Leicester do have that advantage. Ipswich don't. We also spoke about Ipswich having a favourable run-in versus the other two. So if you're a betting man, possibly Leicester and Ipswich are in the box seat to get promoted automatically, and then it will be a very tasty-looking playoff in that case with Leeds, Southampton, probably Norwich and West Brom. So I think it's going to be a fantastic conclusion to the Championship season.
And Derek, we'll stay with you for your team of the week, who are the Chelsea women's side?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it's only half-time, as they say, in the Women's Champions League semi-finals between Chelsea and Barcelona. But many have said that this win for Chelsea 1-0 over Barcelona Feminine is one of the greatest performances of the tenure of Emma Hayes. She's obviously been under some pressure recently. Her post-match antics with Jonas Erdevall in the Women's FA Cup final, she's had to answer a lot of questions there. But they've inflicted Barcelona's first defeat at home since February 2019. It was Erin Cuthbert's goal on the stroke of half-time that did the business. I just want to put this into context for you. Barcelona in their domestic league this season have won 22 of their 23 league games. They've scored 102 goals and they've conceded six. So they have a goal difference of 96 at the moment. So maybe says a little bit about the domestic game in Spain. But this is a formidable team with packed with Spanish players that are now the world champions, including two-time Ballon d'Or winner Alexia Pulisic, who had a chance to actually score in the game and inexplicably sliced the shot wide. Italiana Bonmati was on show as well in front of those 36,000 fans that came and watched the game. What a stunning performance for Chelsea for women's English football, and that amazing run of Barcelona has come to an end. Incidentally, in the other semi-final, Lyon scored three goals in 6 minutes to come from behind and beat Paris Saint-Germain in their women's Champions League semi-final. So advantage Lyon, and as it stands, advantage Chelsea.
Did you want to jump in there, Edge, before you move on to your team of the week, which is another women's side from closer to home? But yeah, Chelsea, quite the juggernaut, as has been the case for a long time.
Yeah, they are, aren't they? They've been at the forefront of women's football in the UK for some time, and that's in their DNA now, isn't it?
Most certainly is. And Melbourne City Women's also in their DNA. They won their first bit of silverware in 4 years. Amazing to think it had been that long three or four weeks ago when they lifted that Premier's plate, and they put themselves right in the frame to host the A-League Women's Grand Final in a couple of weeks and win another double.
Yeah, I thought after we spoke to Dario Vidicic in the main program last week, I took a close look at the Newcastle Jets and Melbourne City A-League Women's semi-final first leg. And all the talk was about Newcastle Jets. They were had a full head of steam. They'd scored 18 goals in four matches leading up to this fixture. They had what was going to be a big crowd behind them, almost 7,000 people at that venue in Maitland. Yet Melbourne City, like the pros that this club is, they went up there and they just were amazing, and they were able to probably put Newcastle out of the tie completely with a 3-0 win away from home. And it sort of reflected the season that Melbourne City had, you know, despite their mid-season blip of losing Holly McNamara, probably the best player in the competition, to a knee injury, and then overseas transfers of Caitlin Torpy and their very good number one goalkeeper, Lorianne Peru. Melbourne City, they just managed to steer the ship and pip Sydney for the title. But it was that sort of dogged determination that well and surely got Melbourne City over the line on the weekend. They shared the responsibility, like they've shared the responsibility for goals throughout the season. They did it again on the weekend with Amina Ekic and also Dadia Galic and young Shelby McBarn scoring their goals. And I just thought the impact of Rebecca Stott in the back line, Laura Hughes in the middle, sort of directing the show, and then Polisina Galic up front. They just were very workmanlike, very professional, and they deserve to go back to Amy Park with a big league and all the pressures now on Newcastle Jets. So that's the reason why I have decided that Melbourne City Women were my team of the week.
And what are you hearing around projected crowds for Amy Park this week, and then onto the grand final? Should they get the job done, as they certainly should from 3-0 up? Because the Maitland result in terms of the crowd was such a success, nearly 7,000. Whereas we were speaking prior about the Central Coast Sydney FC semi final, which had a much smaller crowd, and all of them on the broadcast side as well. So on screen visually, it was a lesser product than the City Jets game, and we know that, you know, that's not always workable. You can't always work around these things. Adelaide United suffered for, you know, quite a while while they were constructing their second side of their stand, and sometimes it's hot, so you want people in the shade. But what are you hearing around the management of these little things that make a big difference?
Well, I think Melbourne City have given themselves a chance to get a good crowd because it's obviously a double header. They've teamed up with the men at Amy Park, and I think they've learnt from last year. They hosted their semi-final at home at out at Casey Fields, which drew a lot of criticism at the time because it just takes so many people out of the equation of going to the game. At least this is in the centre of the city, and the neutrals are likely to go out to see what's going to be a good contest. So I'm not sure what sort of crowd they'll get, but it'll be okay. And it's obviously it'll be a great day at the football. And their men's team have a big match after the match that the girls play.
My team of the week win their nomination through the weight of their performances over the past 2 months or so. It is a club we don't talk about very often at all, and that is Holsten Kiel, right up in the north of Germany towards the Danish border. Interesting history, at least I think so. They were formed in 1900, and they were flying as part of a broader athletics and hockey association, and they became German champions in 1912, but they were then weakened by the First World War, and then they were denied the opportunity to play nationally for a long time, like all German clubs, when the country was split into 16 divisions under the governance of the Third Reich in the 1930s, and they were buried away in the Gauliga Schleswig-Holstein, although they did dominate their little patch. Only in the past decade have they played nationally again. They were in the third tier from 2013-14 to 16-17, and then into the two Bundesliga for the past 7 seasons. With 4 to play, they sit top by a point. They would consider Hamburger SV local rivals, given their sort of geographic proximity, and they beat them 1-0 on the weekend, despite being a man down. There was a red card to Lewis Holtby, which is a name some might remember from the Premier League. They've won their past 6 games. They've only lost once in their last 11, and that was to their other local rival in St. Pauli 4-3. And there should be a fair old party edge in the north of Germany if both of those sides can seal promotion in the coming month or so.
Absolutely. It'll be bigger than Texas, won't it?
Holsten Kiel, my team of the week. Derek, we'll move on to the hot topics, and the scrapping of the FA Cup replays is something that has been coming for a while. The old traditionalists have been railing against it for a long time, but unfortunately, depending on which side of the fence you're on, it is now here.
Yeah, this all came about on the FA Cup semi-final weekend, and needless to say, it caused a lot of discussion. This is the English FA's proposed plans to get rid of replays in the FA Cup. So just to recap, at the moment, if you draw a game in an FA Cup fixture after 90 minutes prior to the semi-finals, it will get replayed at the other team's ground. You know, the arguments for this are fairly simple. For big clubs, particularly those in Europe, this would ease congestion in an already packed fixed schedule. Arteta, when asked about it in his pre-match press conference the weekend, said that, you know, it's something that needed to happen. Manchester City boss Pep Guardiola, you know, said it was, you know, the City are playing an unacceptable amount of games. They had their crushing defeat to Real Madrid during the week, and then were expected to turn up at Wembley on Saturday to play an FA Cup semi-final. There's probably some of the world's smallest violins being played. As I say, they say they're kind of the victims of their own success, and B, what's the squad for if not for that kind of problem? But for the smaller clubs, it means the loss of potential revenue generated. So, for example, if Notts County were able to, you know, get a draw out of Manchester United at home, then they could then enjoy a payday with by splitting the gate receipts at Old Trafford in what probably would have been a televised game as well with extra money. So the likes of Tranmere Rovers have already got the first punch in, saying that if this was to go ahead, they would pull out of the FA Cup entirely, which is a pretty extreme view, but it just shows that the level of frustration that's being shown by teams outside of the Premier League, and certainly outside of the more well-heeled Premier League teams. Of course, you'd lose. There have been many classic FA Cup replays over the years. Who would forget Ryan Giggs's chest rug celebrations versus Arsenal in the semi-final replay back in 1999? You know, Arsenal actually played 5 third round replays against Sheffield Wednesday in 1979. Five replays is probably a bit too much. But there's some great stories to do with them. So like, it's a really hard one because I can see it from the Premier League team's point of view. Like the FA Cup was designed when there wasn't the Champions League, all the way down to Europa Conference League, etc. The fixture congestion is an absolute disaster. But similarly, I think there's a lot of teams in that pyramid who would say, well, these teams have become big as a result of being in this amazing pyramid. They should be remembering that, this trickle down that doesn't happen all too often. You know, why would we want to deny these teams that big payday? So it's nuanced, but I'd say the majority of people think this is a bad thing.
What chance of a revolt if Tranmere Rovers, if all the clubs in the league pyramid, not the little clubs, joined up and said, look, we're not going to play in this until this decision was reversed. Is any chance of that happening?
It would take some coordination. And look, I think historically clubs don't generally band together, even the smaller clubs. So it's definitely something that if I was, you know, a chairman of one of those clubs and I could do a send all to, you know, some kind of email list of all the chairmen, then you try and do it. I suppose the other shoe on the coin, the side of the coin, or the other shoe on the other foot, is what happens if the likes of Manchester City or Arsenal or Liverpool say, well, we can't play FA Cup football anymore, which would be obviously an enormous shame. But if these teams just feel so strongly that they just cannot field competitive teams in every single game of the season, that would surely be to the detriment of the lower clubs. So I hope they can find a compromise somewhere. It's definitely not an easy one. I know in the League Cup that Europe, the clubs in Europe enter the tournament at a later stage. That could be one solution. There could be, you could say, you know, replays until the quarterfinals, for example, when the fixtures are starting to pile up, you know, but don't lose it for the early rounds is another possible option. But I think they've got to try and compromise because you can't have the FA Cup without the likes of Man United, City, and the others. But yeah, if Tranmere aren't there, I think that the competition's tainted forever.
Edge, jump in there with your hot topic, which has been bubbling away all week, and now it is time to officially let rip.
Well, my hot topic is the APL atmosphere of austerity, in other words, cost-cutting. Just to sort of, in the lead-up to this, Simon Hill made some very, very good comments on the ABC over the weekend, which we're going to play in a moment, but I just thought I'd give a bit of a background. Obviously, since the APL was able to, you know, after the 4 or 5 year civil war we had between the owners of the clubs and the Lowy regime at Football Australia, the APL won its long coveted separation in terms of its commercial priorities and the ability to drive its own ship, so to speak. Well, since that time, obviously, we had the great interruption of COVID, which was a big financial impost on the APL, and COVID would have depleted the Silver Lake capital injection pretty significantly. But since that time, we've had, you know, the leadership of Paul Lederer, who was almost silent, never used to make any public comments, left the entire sort of public communication to Danny Townsend. And then only weeks after Danny departed the scene and departed Australia for his big payday in the Middle East, things unravelled with Keep Up, the media arm of the APL being wound up or heavily restricted. And since that time, we've had sort of odd things happen, which all, you know, on their own sort of a little bit forgivable. When you add them all up together, it starts to paint a bit of picture. Who could forget changing the way that the rules around the ladder and not actually communicating to anyone and, you know, mid-season it becoming a bit of a big issue when Melbourne Victory realised, hang on, why are we below this club and we should be above them? That was obviously the beginning of a few different things, and the TV production calamity, you know, slipping venue standards, allowing, you know, Western United to play, which is not really a National League venue. At this point it will be, obviously. And the latest instalment of these sort of things was the decision to axe the Dolan Warren Medal night, which sort of got a lot of people scratching its head. And without me prattling on any further. I thought this is a good opportunity just to dial in the good friend of the show, Simon Hill, who eloquently paints the picture for all our listeners as to the gravity of this decision. Take it away, Simon.
I mean, this is our version of the Dally M's or the Brownlows. Unfortunately, this week, APL have announced that these awards are not going to be held in their usual way. They're going to be announced during the final series, and some of them digitally. This is clearly because of a lack of money. You know, the APL is struggling at the moment financially. I think it's a crying shame, and it's irritating. It smacks of a game that knows the price of everything and the value of nothing. Mm-hmm. And this is something that's really important to our calendar. Two greats of our game, Julie Dolan, who's still with us, Johnny Warren, who, of course, passed away a long time ago. His family say they didn't even know that these awards nights, who've been going for over 20 years, have been cancelled. And the second point I want to make is, you know, there's no shame in saying publicly, look, we'd like to do this, but we can't afford it. I'd like to go on a round-the-world trip for a year and take a year off, but I can't afford it. But the spin that has been put out this week that we're going to, you know, make it an award for the fans, trying to present it as progress, stop trying to pull the wool over fans' eyes. If you're honest about it, the fans might not like the decision, but they will respect you a little bit more if you're open and honest about it. And we all know that the reason they're not being held, unfortunately, is money.
Well, Simon did a great job of describing sort of the atmosphere around this thing. And Willem, it's just another chink in the APL's armour. The context of just, they're just not, you know, they're saying that they're making football their core business, but they continue to make dumb football decisions.
Yeah, we don't have a lot compared to football in other countries. We don't have a lot compared to other codes in the country, but what we do have, we're very proud of. But they just continually keep picking at the threads of you know, of the fabric of the game. So you think about the grand final decision. That was unique to Australia, to Australian football. AFL grand final always at the G Rugby League. Revolves to an extent, but the A-League grand finals were always brilliant because they went to the, you know, you didn't know where they were going to be, but they managed to sell them out every year. So that was something that was taken away, and the spin was there, as Simon says, that was sold to us as, you know, a great progressive decision that was going to be a festival of football and everyone would get up there and have a great time. Everyone absolutely hated it. This is another one. It's not the Dally M. It's not the Brownlow. I don't think thousands and thousands of people tune in for a, you know, for the evening each year, and some people, to be honest, would struggle to list them all off. But if you really care about the game, you know the history. And to put the Warren family offside just shows that there's no consultation, no common sense in the room. The irony I was thinking about this week is that Simon is such a strong voice and one who comes from like traditionalist broadcast and journalism school of thought in terms of keeping people honest. He should be the one in the room being, you know, advising these people. And that would never happen because you can't have the two sort of schools intermingled. They've got to be independent. But he's the type of voice that we need standing up for us, and he needs to be in the corridors of power because the people in there have no idea.
Yeah, it's obvious that they're really struggling with these sorts of decisions, and it's just a great disappointment and another deflating announcement by an administration that, to be honest, has lost the confidence of the fans.
They're seriously battling. They are nowhere. They are getting worse and worse every week. Yeah, it's hugely deflating. And once again, we should be talking about the run into the finals because there's good stuff going on. Yeah, very frustrating. I'd like to close out with a word on Milos Ninkovic. Western Sydney's loss to City on the weekend sees them slide out of the finals places, which means unless they can beat Victory and City stumble, this weekend will be the last in what's been a great professional career. Played for Serbia at the 2010 World Cup against the Socceroos as one of 28 caps he earned for his country. It's sad what happened with his departure from Sydney FC, Edge, and I don't think the pain that cost on all sides was justified in any way by his move to the Wanderers. That just isn't right. But at Sydney, he was in his pomp under the great Graham Arnold sides that dominated for years and years and just won every week and won and won, and you just thought it was never going to end. He was the man, and he's a two-time Johnny Warren medalist winner himself, 2016, 17, and 2020, 21. I'll never forget, do you recall Adrian Niedzielski edged the bald Polish player who was a real ego. Like, he absolutely loved himself. And that season that he was there, Ninkovic just pretty calmly stepped off to the side and let Niedzielski have all the spotlight and all the attention. And they won the championship before Ninkovic stepped back into, you know, the primary role. So a three-time champion, 16, 17, 18, 19 and 19, 20 with premierships in there as well. An Australian citizen. His kids are being raised here and were speaking with their Aussie accents as they paid tribute to their dad before his final home game on the weekend. So he's given a hell of a lot and he's an absolute legend of the A-League. And he could be finishing up this week. So well done, Milos Ninkovic.
Yeah, absolutely. And he's an Australian citizen who's played at a World Cup against Australia. Who could forget
the first time? Is that unique?
Yeah, that must be unique. I don't know if there's any others.
Or maybe Joe Simonich for Croatia.
Yeah, maybe Joe Simonich. That's correct. But obviously, the first time I saw him was when he played at Nelspruit for Serbia against Australia. We got the job done there. Tim Cahill and Brett Holman scoring goals. But he was a fabulous player. He was only young then, obviously. I saw him play. We all sort of pointed this guy out, and little did we know that, you know, in 2024, we're sort of talking about a storied career in our own National League. Fantastic, Milos Ninkovic. What a great contribution to Australian football he's made, and welcome. He should be triumphed, and I think we should be celebrating his contribution to the sport like you've done just then.
Nice, and he should be retained in the game. I think he's going to go into coaching and they need to make sure that takes place here. Brings us to the end of Stoppage Time for another week. Thank you for your company as always and to Adam Maloney behind the scenes for making us sound better than we are. A reminder to get in touch on Facebook, Box to Box, X, Box to Box, NTS, or through the website. Rob Gilbert is going to be back to host the main show on Monday. Please join us from then as we go from one end of the pitch to the other in the World Cup.